All right, it's yet another season preview edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. This one is going to be the Washington Wizards, but I strongly urge you to go back and listen to some of our other ones. Tim Bontemps was great for the Nets. Chris Haynes is really good on the Tristan Thompson situation and the Cavs. Just had Chris Vernon on for the Grizzlies. He had some great thoughts on their future and whether Mike Conley is going to re-sign or not. And we've now, this will be our 10th one. So we're moving right along. And hopefully you'll get a chance to listen to all of them, or at least just the teams you're interested in before the season starts. But enough of this sorry intro. Let's bring in our latest guest, perhaps our most dedicated guest, you can say, given that he's going to be getting married in a mere 2 days, SB Nation and former Bullets Forever writer, Mike Prada.
How are you? Now my fiance is going to hear this podcast. So I'm wondering what the hell I'm doing on a podcast when we're about to get married. So thanks.
Well, you have, if you have an awesome enough fiance to actually listen to your basketball podcast, I think that you have absolutely married a keeper. I think, you know, even if you have to navigate those waters, the fact that she cares enough to listen to you drone on about basketball for an hour on a regular basis is pretty good in itself.
You know, that's a good point. Love you, Hillary. Thanks for listening.
So she really listens. My girlfriend wouldn't be caught dead listening to any of these podcasts. Like, she thinks it's cool that I do them, and she listened to one just so she would know what I was doing, and then she said, you know, I'm not really that interested in that stuff, and I said, okay.
Yeah, now I guess she doesn't listen to every podcast, but she does. You know, we do the sports morning Snapchats that Seth Rosenthal and Roger Sherman does. She watches every one of those, and often I'm on those. So she does pay attention.
Interesting. Yeah, Snapchat is just too much for me right now. I recently expanded into Facebook. I'm a good 5 years behind on social media trends. I do not have an Instagram. I do not have a Snapchat. It's enough just trying to post all my stuff on Twitter and Facebook and, you know, on Real GM and do that little newser and all that stuff. But anyway, all right. Per usual, we are too far afield. Let's start with a little bit of news since you're a national NBA guy as well before we get into the Wizards. John Henson recently extended 4 years, $44 million. Another $4 million in incentives goes down each year, the maximum possible amount, which is pretty smart because they're not really going to be as big a players in 2016 as maybe in 2017, and it's always nice to have a contract that goes down. What did you think of that deal? Good deal for the Bucks, about right? What are your thoughts?
You know, I thought it was a great deal for the Bucks. I've always been a John Henson fan. I think he's got great mobility. He's got great hands and offensive skills around the basket, really good touch. And I looked this up before I jumped on. I was kind of surprised. He ranked very well in rim protection stats last year and the year before. I want to say it was like 47% allowed at the rim, something like that. And I my first thought subjectively is that he's a guy that is pushed around a little bit inside. But those are very impressive numbers. You know, the one interesting thing about this, though, is I don't think he can play with Greg Monroe. I think you would agree with that.
Yeah. No, I do agree with that. And also, while his box score stats are great, great PR, even the good rim protection stats, the advanced stats, the on-off court stuff, has never been as positive about his impact. What do you think of that? Do you think that's just kind of noise? I mean, we've seen guys as they get older who do well in the box score stats. Anthony Davis and Kevin Durant, obviously a different caliber of player, but those are two examples of guys who kind of get it as time goes on, and he was played on a good defense overall last year. And so what do you make of that? Is that a cause for concern with him or not something that you make too much of?
I think there are reasons for it. I don't think he's an especially good pick-and-roll defender. I think he's been pretty raw with some of the fundamentals of defense, and I think that probably drags it down, especially, you know, he played behind Zaza Pachulia, who was basically the anti-Henson. You know, he's very sound positionally, but doesn't have the athleticism or the length. So I think that has a way of obscuring that. And I don't remember off the top of my head what his offensive numbers are, but I do feel like he's the kind of guy that would benefit from playing with shooting around him, and I'm not sure they've always had that in Milwaukee. So I think that those show that he's raw. He's still not quite where he needs to be fundamentally. But given his raw skills, and I mean, he is still young. He's, I guess, what, 24, 23?
Yeah, yeah, I think he'll be 25 once the extension kicks in next summer.
Okay, that's a lot, that's a little older than I figured. But
yeah, because he was a junior when he came out, so
yeah,
a little bit old.
I guess he's a little older than I realized, but I still think that he has the kind of raw skills that if you put him in the right positions, you know, he would succeed. He's kind of always been behind somebody. He's been behind Larry Sanders and still not quite ready last year. Now he gets, he's behind Greg Monroe again, so maybe it's a problem. But I do think that as you put him in the right lineups and as he gets even more experience, especially with the way the Bucks defend, some of those on-off numbers will turn around, even though I know there's kind of a consistent trend. You kind of see that sometimes, I think, with young big men like him.
Well, the other thing that I like about this deal, as I mentioned, it goes down. Greg Monroe could be a free agent in 2 years. And mm-hmm. if that experiment doesn't necessarily work out, if he decides that he wants to move on, if the Bucks want to move on from him, they have a guy who probably won't be an upper echelon starting center due to his limitations offensively and the fact that he's never going to have kind of the girth to really guard a lot of centers in the post. But as a stopgap starting center, if you project out what he's going to be, you know, 27 years old, he'll have 3 years left on that contract. It would be below market for a starting center. I think that's good. It's a nice backup plan for him. If they want to, they'll have plenty of money in free agency in 2017 if Monroe were to leave. So they could go in another direction at another position and feel like he'll at least be okay at what would be a relatively cheap salary.
Yeah, and you said this before, but, you know, we're getting to the point where $15 million is about average for a starter. And you get Henson, who's probably a 2.5 as far as, like, he's a 2.5 big. He's a little
yeah.
too overqualified for a third big, but he's not quite a starter.
Yeah.
You get him at
and also,
million.
Also doesn't have the versatility as well to kind of shift to the four. I mean, I think he can do that okay defensively, but offensively he's strictly a center, and this is a spacing challenge team, so when you're looking at a backup big, the ability to shift between those two positions can make you valuable, and I don't know that he really has that.
That's true, although I will say the fact that he can protect the rim and he has that length and he has that ability to kind of catch and throw passes or catch and finish on the pick and roll does allow you to play a smaller person at the four. So while he doesn't offer the same versatility, he maybe gives you the ability to play more people alongside him, I suppose. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, to be clear, I think this was a good deal. I think we're in agreement on that. All right, another one, devastating injury for the Charlotte Hornets. I had liked them as probably one of my best bets in the over-under podcast to go over their 32.5. I still think they probably are a decent bet to go over, but not someone I would be all over. They had a chance to be a playoff team. What are they losing now with MKG basically being out for the season with a torn labrum?
I think it's a devastating loss. And it's a little bit of an indictment on their wing rotation that this is a devastating loss. I mean, right now, they have Nicholas Batum's going to start. Who's their starting two going to be? Jeremy Lamb? Maybe they'll put 2 point guard lineups. It's looking pretty bleak on the wing. And I also think that the way they build their defensive scheme, you know, they protect Al Jefferson and they kind of do it wing out in a way that kind of maximizes not only Kid Gilchrist's individual defense, but also his ability to kind of play on the nail and kind of help out with his length. And now they don't have that. And there are very few players in the league that can play the 2-9 and play, not the 2-9, play the nail the way that Kid Gilchrist does. So I just think, I know their over-under looked very low. I think this pushes them down quite a bit into, I would probably lock in the under for them at this point. Given their point differential, given how bad they've been without Kid Gilchrist in the past 2 years, and given how little depth they have behind him, I just think it's a real devastating loss. And it's also devastating for him, and you know, on some level, he's probably happy he got his money, but, you know, if he had stayed healthy and kind of played through the season, I think he would have been in for a big payday. So in that respect, I think it's good that he got $13 million a year by now.
Yeah, that's true. And this is one of the things that people always forget, right? We always project out that there's going to be health, there's going to be good performance, he's going to take the next step for young guys. And that's because those things generally hold true. But in the case of Kid Gilchrist, you're getting life-changing money. And granted, he was the number two pick, so he got been paid pretty decently already. But he's locking in life-changing money. He'll still be young enough to become a free agent. Again, I think he got a player option on that deal, as I recall as well, in the last year. And so he probably took a little bit less to be able to do that. And now that probably looks like a decent decision because he's going to have missed the entire year. He's going to miss the development time with his shot, the chance to prove that he's improved with his shot, you know, maybe be a part of a playoff team. So that's why you do this, because for a lot of people, and I never blame anyone for this, having a 100% chance at $52 million might mean more to you than an 80% chance at $75
million. Yeah, I mean, that's totally true. The interesting thought, though, is let's say he didn't sign this. How much would you pay him next summer, given that Wes Matthews got so much money coming off a torn Achilles? I almost wonder if these injuries don't really matter as much, especially if you need wing help. You know, how much would you – or I guess he would be a restricted free agent, so you'd have to overpay even more. I mean, how much would you pay to Gilchrist at this point? I might pay him $13 million or $14 million anyway.
Yeah, no, I think maybe that's the case, and in some ways, his downside is almost lower if he misses his downside is almost higher if he misses the entire year than if he plays, because if he plays, he could just have a bad year. He could just regress on his shooting. Another year goes by when you think, all right, there just isn't any more upside with this guy due to his offensive limitations. So now at least there's still the hope that that can happen. Something could happen this year where you're like, all right, it's just not going to happen for him. So it's an interesting point for all this, but certainly when you have a chance at that kind of money, and also just the fact that he can get back on the market again, he's already a really young guy. You know, I think he'll be a free agent again at 26 if he turns down that last year option. I think that I understand why he went in that direction. All right, next one before we get into the Wizards. Omer Asik is out for the Pelicans for 2 to 3 weeks, I believe, with a calf kind of thing that could be a nagging injury. Alexis Ajinsa also out 4 to 6 weeks, which is a pretty significant amount of time, with a hamstring pull. They now basically don't have any centers. What does this mean for the Pelicans now?
I think this is a really interesting time for them because they've been so consistent on not playing Anthony Davis at the five. I think they want to protect him. They don't want him to pick up, you know, he has an injury history. He's had a lot of nicks and bruises. They don't want him to have to absorb the pounding, and they re-signed both these guys for that reason. And it almost reminds me a little bit of, I mean, I don't think we're going to have the same impact, but it's similar to this idea of David Lee gets injured, and so now there's some talk about, oh, we want to get Draymond Green more involved, but now they actually have the chance to do it, and they had resisted it before, and it worked out so well for the Warriors. I'm not saying it's going to work out this way for the Pelicans. I think it very well might not, but it's a very similar situation where they're kind of forced to do things that they don't want to do, but maybe will be better for them, but maybe won't. You know, so I think it's going to be really interesting to watch them over the next, you know, few weeks, because I mean they have no other centers. They have Kendrick Perkins and that's it. And you know, I don't think they're going to play Kendrick Perkins very much. I would hope not. So we really might get Anthony Davis to five, and we really might get an answer to, is the pounding really that big a deal, or is it one of those things where we think it's a big deal and he can actually handle it quite well, and the matchup advantage it provides is actually a significant positive for them.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that him playing at center is their best lineup, but I think this spells trouble overall for the Pelicans for a number of reasons. One is they don't even have any other fours on the roster other than Davis and Ryan Anderson. So, and it's the only three front court players they have are those two and Perkins. Perkins obviously is a replacement level guy at best, really shouldn't be playing an NBA game regularly at this point. They may have to play him more. And then the other problem is Quincy Pondexter is out, And Pondexter's was the only guy really that could enable them to kind of move up and play the four. And he's going to be out for at least the beginning of the year as well, it looks like. And I think all of these guys are potentially guys for whom these injuries could linger. Drew Holiday also is going to be on a minutes limit. So as has often been the case in New Orleans in these last few years, they're going to have a lot of minutes now going to guys who basically probably should not be in an NBA rotation, and that just drags you down.
Yeah, health is a huge problem for them. There's no question. I'm guessing we're going to see a lot of Dante Cunningham, which I've always liked this game, but I know a lot of people don't. So, yeah,
He's not that terrible at the four. At the three, though, I think it's kind of a disaster offensively.
Well, now he might play more at the four, so maybe that'll be a good
thing. Yeah, maybe that's what it is, right? I'm looking at their depth chart. He's listed as a three, but yeah, so that's actually, but then now they don't have a three, right? I mean,
right. Yeah.
So with Pondexter being out, it's going to be CDR, Alonzo G, Luke Babbitt, it's really, and this is a team where we had hoped that we might see a defensive renaissance. Holiday's out, Ashik is out, Ajinsa is out, Ryan Anderson, not that good defensively at the four. Pondexter out is another good defender. So the quest to begin the defensive improvement, which is really a bigger thing for Gentry and Darren Erman, the defensive coordinator there, that's going to be a struggle now.
Yeah, it is. It's just that there is a chance, I would say maybe a 20-25% chance, that all the matchup advantages of Anthony Davis at the five on both ends, in a system that actually makes sense to put Anthony Davis at the five and not what Monty Williams did, is just going to trump all of that. You know, that there's a chance that will be the case. The same way, I think, similar to where putting Draymond Green at the four, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but there's a chance that it's one of those transformative moves that totally changes the way the entire team looks. And that's why I'm really interested to see what happens, because it's possible that if both Ashik and Ajinsa don't get hurt, we never get that opportunity to see, because they just won't try it. And now they have to try it.
Yeah, I think they would have tried it anyway. I think that because if you're going to play Ryan Anderson, you're going to play him more minutes than just only when Anthony Davis is off the floor. So I think, but I do think that starting lineup will be very effective. It's just whenever somebody from the bench comes in with how thin they're going to be early on in the year, I think there's going to be a massive, massive drop-off. All right, before we get into the Wizards, let me tell you all a little bit about SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the inaugural Dunked On Basketball Podcast sponsor. It's a fantastic app, free, takes a minute to download. Because it's on your phone, you don't have to go through all that prove I'm not a robot stuff on there. You can basically aggregate all the tickets on the internet at your fingertips on one app. You don't have to go to 10 different sites wondering, oh man, did I get the best deal? Like, when am I going to stop? You know, how much is it worth to try and save 5-10 bucks on tickets? You got it all right there in front of you. And they have a metric called deal score that tells you how good on a rating of 0 to 100 a particular ticket is. You can get sporting events, NBA starting up soon, football, obviously concert tickets as well. You can use it. And it's really a fantastic product. If you use my code, which is CAPSPACE, all one word, you can remember that easily because we talk about CAPSPACE a lot in this podcast, you can get $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. And even if you're not planning on using it now, go ahead and sign up. Your $20 will be waiting for you whenever you want to get your NBA tickets. That's SeatGeek, CAPSPACE code, all one word. All right, Mike. Wizards, this is your hometown team. Probably the biggest season that we can think of, at least in my lifetime, for the Wizards coming up. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, just think about the Summer Stakes. It's absolutely their biggest season in 30 years.
I mean, the way I think of this season, and it's fascinating for what they're going to do this year, I'm not sure that they're an Eastern Conference title contender, probably not an NBA title contender, but how well they do this year is essential because they need to prove to Kevin Durant that coming there is a better chance to win a championship than if he were to stay in Oklahoma City. What kind of record do you think they need to get to? Where do they need to finish in the playoffs to kind of really be an appealing destination for him?
You know, it's tough. Let's assume that the reason he would come to the Wizards are entirely basketball related and not, you know, coming home or anything outside of the outside of basketball.
Yeah,
you know, let's assume that. I mean, I think the answer is probably yes, but yeah, I just want to cover our bases here.
Yeah, I think of that stuff as kind of ancillary, like little bit of thumb on the scales. But you only start thinking about that stuff if you answer the threshold question of can we contend or not.
Yeah, I agree. I just want to. It's possible it won't quite be this threshold I'm throwing out there, I guess. But
yeah, sure.
I think they need to win at least 50 games, and I think they probably need to make the conference finals to really cement themselves as a team on the rise. I think it's, you know, if they have a competitive second round series and they don't make the conference finals, it's probably okay, but I think they look a lot better if they emerge as really the second best team to Cleveland. And that, because even with Russell Westbrook there, Oklahoma City's loaded. So they still, even though it's the West, they still have a great chance. I think they got to get to 50. And then I think they probably need to, you know, last year you could argue they probably would have made the conference finals if John Wall didn't get injured. I think this year they've kind of got to cross that threshold, because I think in their mind, they probably think, you know, we should have been there instead of Atlanta.
Do you agree with that?
You know, when he got in game one, I thought was very impressive. I think they could have won one or at least two of those at home. And then when he came back, I don't think he was quite the same. So, I do think they would have won that series. I'm not quite sure, you know, if they would have won it in six, if, you know, maybe it would have taken seven. But, no, I do agree. I think they would have won that series. Because game two, I think, was kind of a throwaway. You know, they were right there in game four. Obviously, they come one basket away in game five when Wall comes back. He's not quite himself. And then they're right there in game six. So having a healthy player like Wall, I think, would have definitely tipped the scales.
Yeah, so, you know, we've started getting into this already. I always talk about kind of how good a team was last year to establish a baseline, look at how guys might improve. This team, 46-36 a year ago, expected one loss based on their point differential, only 43-39. But I also think that once they got it in the playoffs with playoff Whitman playing Pierce and or Porter at the four, shooting more threes, and now the fact that they're carrying that over, you can make the argument that at least by the time they got to the playoffs, they're much better quality-wise than a 46-36 and certainly a 43-39 team.
Yeah, that's the thing. They were almost two teams last year, and really they were almost three teams, although I think the team one and team two are kind of the same. You know, they get up to that great start. I think they're 19-6. They kind of carry it through to January, and then they just have an awful February and March where their offense dips to, I want to say, 29th in the league other than the Sixers. And they kind of limp into the playoffs. And then, like you said, they change their style and suddenly they're a totally different team. You know, I think that they were probably a little overrated to start the year and they kind of came back to haunt them. But yeah, everybody's talking about the style change. And, you know, part of me is always a little skeptical, but then they go out and they had 109 possessions in their first preseason game. I think they're really serious about amping up this small ball thing, and it's going to be really interesting. It's very hard to gauge because of that, how good the team was last year, like you said. So I would say probably they're a little closer to their 46-36 than they were to where their point differential was.
Yeah, and the defense, fifth last year, according to Basketball Reference, by points per possession, 22nd in offense. Usually I think of, from a style change, a coaching change, defense is easier to improve, but we have seen teams go smaller, most notably, and also change up their system, most notably the Warriors last year, and really improve their offense kind of more based on coaching and system than anything else. What do you think is the offensive ceiling for this team as far as where they're going to rate in the league this year? Because I think the defense, maybe I might expect that to regress a little bit with the bigs and actually, you know, playing the two bigs together less, and those guys just getting a little older. But how much can the offense get better if they just change up the system, in your view?
Well, I don't think it's just changing up the system. The other big thing they've done is they've really changed, I think, the supplementary personnel. You know, you look at last year, they brought in a lot of big men. They bring in Chris Humphreys. They bring in Juwan Blair. They bring in Drew Gooden. They keep Drew Gooden. They're kind of overloaded with bigs last year, and they really had very little wing depth, especially because Whitman was not playing Otto Porter, and Rasul Butler, his three-point shooting predictably kind of fell off a cliff after a hot start. They're very weak there. This year, they have, I think, a lot of wing options. You've got Jared Dudley. You have Alan Anderson. You have even Kelly Oubre. You maybe have a return to health in Martell Webster, although he's already complaining about health issues. And of course,
yeah, they're kind of hoping he doesn't return to health, at least not until 12 games have passed in the season.
Yeah.
That joke, of course, is because his contract becomes fully guaranteed last year or next year if he plays 70 games. That would cost him about $3.5 million in cap space if it does. But anyway, sorry, continue.
Yeah, and luckily for them, I suppose, he's already talking about hip arthritis, so that's not a good sign. And then, but you also got Otto Porter, and so now it's like their entire roster, even if they didn't change their style, if Randy Whitman just walked in and said, okay, guys, we're playing small and shooting a lot of threes now, they actually have a roster that kind of, that's what you would have to do anyway. They don't have a lot of, as much front court depth anymore, and suddenly they're overloaded with wings. So what's the offensive ceiling of this team? I think for them to really call this a success, they've got to get into push the top 10, I think. And I think there's a chance it might happen. I know I'm sort of drinking the preseason Kool-Aid on this, but I think for a lot of Wizards fans, this is kind of
all
overdue.
Every single one of my guests has so far. So I was joking about that on Twitter, that I think every team guest that we've had has been over their team, in their prediction, has been over their team's over-under in Vegas, which it's not surprising. I mean, when you're around the team, when you see guys, you know, and I think everyone on the team feels that way too. You see guys just going against the backups on your own team, and everyone's healthy, obviously, too. Everyone kind of projects out health. It's very easy to kind of fall into that trap. I mean, I guess we'll see whether you do or not. Or whether it even is a trap when you do your prediction.
Maybe it's not a trap. It is interesting
that I noted. What did you say?
Maybe it's not a trap. I mean, we said last year about the Warriors. People were really excited about them in the preseason.
Yeah.
That wasn't a trap. But yeah, you're right. It is a little Kool-Aid drinking. But you put John Wall around a bunch of shooters, and it's going to make everybody more unstoppable. The thing that makes this style change long overdue is that the three best players on the team all are better for playing small. And that's why I think they could push the top 10. And I think they have to push the top 10 because I do think the defense might fall off a little bit.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it looks like they're still going to be starting either Humphreys or Gooden at the four. And that is clearly a downgrade, I think, no matter how you slice it, against, as opposed to Nene, who, granted, missed a bunch of time last year. Gortat, getting into his early 30s, you have to imagine that he's maybe not going to be as good as he was last year, and was never amazing. You know, he's fine, but never amazing. I always thought Whitman, when you consider the defensive personnel this team had, deserved a lot of credit, he and his staff, for the defensive performances he was able to get out of these guys.
Yeah, I agree, and that's the one big question, right? So they're playing smaller, and so much of what they did defensively was kind of built around the fact that they had this wall of bodies in the paint. They were, I think, one of the top teams in the league at fewest attempts in the restricted area, and now they don't have that same effect because it seems like they're moving Nene to a back of five behind and playing him in tandem with Gortat. And you know, they're having Humphreys shooting all these threes in the preseason. It's going to be interesting to see if that carries over. So it is going to be interesting to see what they do with the defense. I think 2 years ago they were a little, when they had Trevor Ariza, they did more switching. They did more kind of pressured defense on the wing. Last year they didn't quite have the personnel for that, so I thought it was more conservative. So you're right. Given the talent, Whitman's done a great job and on that end, and that's what they're counting on, is that he can do it again. again. I will say this. I know Gortat is getting up there in years, but I do think that he actually might be better this year because they're playing small more often. I think playing with another big, he's never been as effective in his career doing that. And now, you know, he's talked about it, and I think there's something to this, that the fact that there's much more space for him to set screens and roll, which is what he's really good at, I think may make him better even though he's older.
Yeah, I think that's probably right, certainly on the offensive end. One concern that I have, though, is I don't know if Chris Humphreys is really that good. I don't know if Drew Gooden is really that good. You're going to be starting these guys now to get a little more stretch than you did with Nene, a little bit more in transition. But it still is kind of a downgrade when you look at what Nene has been over the last few years at the four, and Jared Dudley is not going to be quite ready yet. I like it better if Dudley can start playing the four once he gets back. We don't know what he's going to be health-wise. Do you look at that four spot as being a little weak at the moment?
Yeah, I think it is a little weak. You know, there's no question. Humphreys and Gooden, they're starting to shoot a lot more threes, but we'll see how that carries over. I think Dudley is coming back sooner than expected, but I don't think he can play 30 minutes a game. You know, I think the big reason he was traded for so little is that there were big concerns that he would stay healthy. So, you know, I think that it is a weakness. The one thing, again, the one counter I'd have is that, you know, it's a small sample size, but I thought this was kind of interesting. Last year, the Wizards starting lineup with Nene overall, I think, was plus 7.4 per 100 possessions for the season. And it's been a very strong unit for them over the years. But as it went along through the year, I think teams kind of figured it out. After February, they were only a plus 1.1 per 100 possessions. So most of the skill they had was early in the year. And then the playoffs, obviously, it was a disaster, and they only started to play well when they would go small. So, you know, offensively, I think it'll be, even though Humphreys and Gooden are kind of underwhelming, and we'll see if they shoot threes as well, I think it's going to be a big upgrade. It is possibly going to be a downgrade defensively, but I think there's a chance that even though Nene has this great pedigree, even though he has been so good at the four, even though defensively that's been such a strong lineup, that the league may have figured it out, and now they need to try something different. And if those guys are even stretching their range out a few steps, I think those steps will make a big difference, and it may not be the same defensive downgrade that it would have been 2 years ago. I mean, that's what they're counting on. You know, we'll see how it plays out, but, you know, I thought it was interesting the way that over the course of the year, the Wizards' nominal starting lineup really started to become less and less effective each month.
Yeah, that is interesting, and maybe that unit has run its course, and you say, hey, if we're this bad on offense, we have to make a change. Maybe it'll downgrade the defense, maybe it won't, but and then they had so much success in the playoffs, too. For individual performance, projecting for this year, who on this team are you looking at as candidates to get a lot better?
I think you have to look, there are really only two obvious ones, notwithstanding what I just kind of said about Gortat. I think it's got to be Bradley Beal. It's got to be Otto Porter. And other than that, you know, this is a pretty veteran team. You know, you might see John Wall take a little bit of a step statistically because of the way the floor is open. But I think anyone who's watching.
Let me stop you with Wall before you move on to Beal and Porter. I feel like Wall, maybe it won't happen for him, but he has a very obvious way in which he could improve his game, and that's something. And it's in a way that players often improve as they get older.
Yeah, I mean,
and I'm talking about his shooting.
Yeah, certainly. I think he could get better. I think it's also possible that he will stay the same. He had, I thought, a great year last year. He might also just be more statistically dominant because he's going to get more assists. He's going to. Players are going to be more open. He's going to have a little more space. So I suppose statistically he probably will get better. And if he can shoot a little better, all the more. But I think the two obvious ones are still Beal and Porter. Beal, because he's talked so much about cutting out the long twos. I thought it was kind of funny watching the game the other night. There were two or three times early in the game where he was about to start shooting his long two, and then he stopped himself, and it was a turnover. So he's still getting used to not just pulling up in 16 feet all the time. So he's got to get better, and hopefully this new system will. And Porter just over the course of the season, you know, he's got to be better than he was last year. So it's got to be those three guys, I think. And other than that, you know, the hope is just that everybody else stays at about the same level to kind of enable those three guys to get better in their own way.
I think actually another low-hanging fruit for Wall, and this is something that I think will really be helped by the additional spacing, is he's a really high turnover player. He had an 18.7% turnover percentage last year, and when he's not driving into a ton of trees in the middle and there's more shooting around him, I think that helps make those decisions easier. You don't have to thread the needle as much. You don't have hands reaching in as you're trying to drive to the basket. So I think that can is another way that he can improve, even if the shooting doesn't get to where people kind of want it to be.
Yeah, I think so. I guess the difference, the difference of opinion is that I think he will be the same player, but the conditions are finally set up for him to thrive. And so therefore, his numbers will look better. And for that reason, and for the more assists, easier to score around the rim, better screens being set for him, you know, even the ability to kind of rotate the ball and rest a little bit so he can try harder on defense. I just think the conditions are really set up for him. So, but I think he's the same player he always has been. It makes sense. The team is built around him now.
Yeah, and when he gets ahead of steam, there's no one really better at finishing at the basket. I think Beal is really interesting. I mean, his reputation, partially because he's been better in the playoffs, has always kind of outstripped what he was doing statistically over the course of a season. He did average 23 a game in the playoffs. I thought in that article by Jorge Castillo about him getting rid of the long twos, I thought it was really encouraging to hear him say that, and Randy Whitman say, if he's spotting up, it always needs to be a three. And, you know, the two-point jumper is fine if you're going to take a dribble in and, you know, it's there for you and you're wide open, you know, maybe take that. So I think that's all encouraging. Do you think he can improve from last year based on his playoff performance? And what was he even doing in the playoffs that made him so much better?
He's always been better in the playoffs, I think, because he's a little more aggressive in the playoffs. I think he settles for jumpers so much in the regular season, but in the playoffs, especially with Wall injured, you just need him to get to the basket more. You need him to be a little more fearless. And when he's a little more fearless, suddenly he's not just shooting 16-foot jumpers all the time. And I think that's why you see that in the playoffs, that jump. I think a lot of times he's worried about getting injured. He's had a lot of problems with his leg, and this is one of the first summers where he's really not had to deal with some sort of problem. Last year, he kind of looked really good, and then he hurt his wrist, and that, I think, set him back a little bit. If he can stay healthy, I think that's a big part of it. And then the fact that the court is spaced so much better, he's not suddenly in a position where he has to, if he comes off a pick and roll, the only really good thing available to him is the 16-foot jumper. So I think it's twofold. And to answer your question of why he's better in the playoffs, I think he just he has to step up his game. And now the conditions are better so that even the shots he settles for are going to be more efficient shots than it would have been in the past.
All right, so I think we kind of hit on already who's a decent bet to get worse. But from a national perspective, this isn't a team still that gets a lot of national attention despite being in the playoffs the last few years. But who is better on this team than maybe people realize in a national sense?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think this team is pretty well pegged. I don't think there are too many players that are better or worse. I think in the past, Nene was better than people gave him credit for, but I think he's kind of slowed down a little bit. Otto Porter obviously had his breakout. I think a lot of Wizards fans were hoping he would play more earlier, and that it was kind of shackled a little bit by the coach and the way he was used. He was used in poor lineups, and of course he looks better when he plays with better players, and that was kind of long overdue, and this will continue. I think Gortat is a little better than people give him credit for defensively. You know, he didn't come in with a great reputation as a rim protector, but he's really very solid positionally. I don't know what his actual numbers at stopping shots at the rim once they get there are. I don't have those off the top of my head. But he's very sound positionally. He goes straight up. He doesn't really foul very much at the rim. And you know, it's a bit the big reason that the team limited the number of shots from the restricted area is that Gortat was kind of very good at preventing those through his coverages, and I think that's underrated. As far as he's maybe a little overrated, I think Nene isn't just his impact. People still talk about him, I think, as a very important member of the way they defend, and I think that was true 2 years ago, but I think now he's really lost a step. He's kind of lost his explosion. And, you know, maybe he'll be a little revived playing center, but I don't think he's quite as vital a player as he used to be.
Yeah, I think there's a feeling now that he's just not quite capable of playing starters' minutes. He always seems to have some kind of nagging injury that's dragging him down. One of the things that I wanted to ask you, though, Otto Porter basically did nothing all last year. All of a sudden gets in the rotation. They're playing small. Shoots 37% from three in the playoffs, only about, I think, a 15% usage rate, so pretty small. It was perceived as a breakout playoffs, especially when they were just, he had a couple of nice games when they were throttling the Raptors. But are you convinced, obviously he's young, he has a lot of potential, but are you like, as watching this team, all right, we're good at small forward, he's going to be a starting quality small forward, don't have to worry about that position?
I'm more convinced, I think, than most, because I think that he did not get enough of a chance in the regular season. Like, I think if he had been given the chance to play with starters and to kind of be the fifth guy that kind of fills in and to have the chance, maybe he doesn't have to take the most difficult perimeter assignment right off the bat. He can kind of float a little bit, use his length and passing lanes. I think if he really had a chance to play to his strengths, he would have shown more in the regular season, but he just never got that chance. They put him on the second unit with, you know, Kevin Sarafin posting up and, you know, Drew Gooden shooting 20-footers and Chris Humphrey shooting 20-footers and, you know, with Andre Miller really being slow and no other shot creators. And that does not play to his strength. He's always been a guy, I think, that plays better when he plays with better players. That's kind of always been his thing. And so if you plug him in with a spaced lineup and tell him, you know, he gets open looks from running the floor, he can back cut players that are not paying attention, and he can step in passing lanes and really do wreak havoc on the nail, kind of like Kate Gilchrist does. You know, I don't think he's the individual defender that Kid Gilchrist is, but I think he has that same capability of kind of just throwing his arms in the way of what makes an easy pass a little harder. So I'm relatively confident that he can keep it up. You know, the one concern would be that he's not a great one-on-one defender yet, and I don't think he's really that great navigating screens. He kind of still gets shoved off a little too easily, and, you know, his shooting. We'll see if his shooting carries through. I mean, 37% is lower than I would have thought just watching highlights, but that's still an improvement from where he was. So those, I think, would be
right.
Concerns. But I think that if he had shown, if Randy Whitman had given him the chance to play to his strength, he would have shown more in the regular season, and then suddenly maybe his playoff doesn't just come out of nowhere. I think the switch to the small lineup really finally unlocked the kinds of things he could do.
Yeah, and he's a nice cutter. Has some good length, can get on the offensive glass on occasion, make some hustle plays as well. And you started to hit on this. Is he ready to be this team's best perimeter defender? Can he guard Jimmy Butler, LeBron James, Kevin Durant, those kind of guys? Or are they going to be hurting at that spot a little bit?
I'm not sure he can, but it's possible he doesn't have to because they have Allen Anderson too. And they have Jared Dudley. And they have the capability. If they play small, they don't have to put Otto Porter on the toughest matchup. You know, if they have that flexibility, and that's their hope. I mean, we'll see if those guys can hold up for one more year. You know, they're already dealing with some minor injuries, and they're both in their 30s. But I think that's the logic where, you know, Otto is good against guys that are maybe skinnier and ISO more but don't have the strength. You know, but if you have to go against a guy who's stronger, you can put Anderson or Jared Dudley on those guys. Anderson is better, is stronger in his lower body, and Dudley obviously has played four for a while now, so he can go against bigger players. So that the answer, maybe they don't need him to be that. I guess it depends. You know, if they start, will they then start the game going small? You know, that's an open question. But you know, I don't know if they need him to be the number one guy. I think in some matchups he can be, and in some matchup, you know, they'll rely on Anderson and Dudley. They have that flexibility, which I think is kind of nice.
Yeah, and last year they still managed to be fifth in defense without anyone in the starting lineup you would look at as a stopper on the wing, although Beal did well in the playoffs against Korver. I don't think he can guard threes necessarily with his size, but he was improved, and he's talked about wanting to be all defense this year. So maybe they don't necessarily need him to be that, but then he also had the two bigs behind him for a lot of the year. All right, this is my next question. This is going to be a real interesting one for you, especially with what we've talked about with them maybe playing small. Playoff time comes around. Let's assume everyone is as healthy as you can reasonably project that they are going to get. What is your crunch time lineup for this team?
I think it's got to be Anderson or Dudley with the starters playing small. I think that would be
ideal. With either Gooden or Humphreys taken out.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, what's interesting is, you know, this kind of happened in January last year, and this was kind of a big little thing. Will Gortat be on the floor in those situations, or will there be situations that they'd rather have Nene in the game? I think that'll be kind of interesting to watch, because last year, you know, there was a big deal for a while that Gortat would sit fourth quarters, and I think to some degree it was a little silly, but to another degree, you know, sometimes late in games you want to be small and you want to have the flexibility to switch. It's why Cleveland closed with Thompson over Mozgov for so much of the year. So it's possible that we may see Gortat sit some fourth quarters again, and we'll see how he feels about that. But I think that other than that, I think you're going to see one of the wings in instead of Humphreys or Gooden, because that way they can take, again, the tougher assignment. They can guard LeBron, the Jimmy Butler, you know, those guys down the stretch. I guess the Dwayne Wade, if he's healthy. They don't have to put that on Otto. They can kind of play one of those players and have Otto in passing lanes. So that's what I think they're going to do.
And you mentioned already maybe who's going to play at center in the crunch time lineup, who's going to play on the wing. Are there any other kind of playing time issues that you see Coach Whitman having to adjudicate, any battles for certain positions in the rotation that you're going to be watching?
Yeah, I think, first of all, the who plays, if Nene is out for a while, like who is going to play behind Gortat? That's kind of a big question. And how do you distribute the wing minutes when everyone's healthy? You know, how much is Anderson going to play? How much is Terry Neal going to play? Is he going to play much at all? You know, or are they going to kind of use him for scoring? So it's hard to kind of put it based on a position, because they are so positionalist on the wing. They have so many 2-3 types, and they need those players to cover three positions. But, you know, that would strike me as interesting, is how, if everybody's healthy, how much is Allen Anderson playing? How much is Jared Dudley playing? How much is Otto Porter playing? And how much is Gary Neal playing? You know, it might depend from game to game, but when you do that, you have to rely on a coach to make the right call, and sometimes, most of the time they do, and sometimes they don't. So that might be a source of conflict that might cost them a couple games.
Do you like Allen Anderson better or Jared Dudley better for this lineup, maybe that closing lineup, assuming that they're both healthy?
You know, it'll depend on matchup. I like Allen Anderson as a player better, I think, just because he played crunch time a lot for Brooklyn. I think his shooting is kind of the one thing. It could be a little better, but you see all these wings that come and play with John Wall and shoot better. It's kind of something that they always do, and he's very good at catch, shot faking, and driving. He's aggressive, and he's a tough defender that's always made Brooklyn's lineups better. I think if you're looking for the guy who's kind of going to be like, okay, that guy, I got LeBron, I have Jimmy Butler, I have Dwayne Wade, I want to take that challenge, and I'm capable of taking that challenge. That strikes me, Allen Anderson strikes me as more of that kind of guy. If you have a matchup where Otto Porter can handle that, then I think you'd rather have Jared Dudley's help defense on the floor. So probably it would depend on matchups. I just like Anderson's game more, but you could use either one. I think it really just depends. I know it's kind of a cop-out answer, but you know, that's kind of the roster they've built. They want to have be able to make those kinds of choices.
Yeah, I think I like Dudley maybe a little better just because he can kind of do some more of the four things, has a little bit more heft. I trust him a little bit more shooting from three-point range, but I think also Anderson might be a better bet to be healthy and is more of a transition guy. So, I think it really depends on what the matchups are, to be sure. What are the key questions for this team that you're going to be watching where you say, all right, if this goes well, they could really exceed expectations, have a great year. If this goes poorly, we're looking at a disappointment.
Well, number one is how committed are they to this style change? And what happens when they have two or three players injured and they can't really play the style they want and they're struggling and they need to kind of right the ship? Like, do they go back to what they previously knew, or do they kind of keep this up and really try to push through? You know, because everybody plays faster in the preseason. Everybody says, we want to play fast. We want to open the floor. What happens when they're, I don't know, 20-21 and they're a little, they're underachieving a little and, you know, people are grumbling about how tired they feel. You know, are they going to keep doing what they do? That's the number one question, I think. Right after that, I think is Bradley Beal ready to be their number two scorer? Really, they're, you know, if you look at their roster, they don't have John Wall is not his strength to kind of be the crunch time guy. You know, last year they used Paul Pierce for that role in a lot of ways. And I think they need Beal to be able to step up and create offense late in games. And I'm not sure he's quite ready for it. He needs to be ready for that. I think if they want to win 50 plus and make the conference finals, they need that. So his development is really important.
Yeah, a lot of those possessions in the playoffs and crunch time devolved into John Wall taking a mid-range jumper, which is not his strength either because they switched the pick and roll or just they weren't really able to create an opening or they weren't getting into the offense quickly enough. That was a concern, I thought, especially in those last couple of games of the Hawks series. They really had some bad possessions late, as I recall it. Yeah, I think that's one. And then I think whether Wall can take another step with his jump shot is going to be a big thing for me as well. You wrote a nice piece last year in the playoffs about, you know, going under the pick and roll doesn't work that well against Wall because he's just so brilliant with his passing. But if he could actually make guys pay for that and come out on him, that could even open up a whole nother level here. And I think that they will be subject to that tactic a lot more of guys going under when the floor is more spread to kind of prevent that initial opening from occurring where you have to bring help from the guys on the perimeter. So that's something that I'll be watching as well. And then just whether the defense can hold up now with really these guys at the four, either playing a small guy, Humphreys and Gooden, not really good defensive players at all in their careers. So those are the things that I will be watching. All right, give me a predicted record.
You want to skip the best and worst case? Okay.
No, that's after.
Okay. I think they will get to 50 even. I'm much more bullish on this year's team than last year's team. I thought last year's team, there was a little too much too soon. I thought there were too many questions, and it kind of played out that way. This year, I think they get to 50. I'm not sure they get to the conference finals because I think they're going to have to beat someone like Atlanta or Miami or Chicago. I think there's a chance they're good enough to do that, but I just don't know if they have enough late-game offense to kind of win those tight ones. So, but I'm going to say they get to 50 wins, and I think they, even though they don't make the conference finals, I think they do enough in the minds of the public to say that this is a team that's pretty close.
Yeah, I recently wrote a piece on Sports Illustrated with the Cauldron about the teams that could potentially challenge Cleveland. That's Miami, Chicago. I decided to put Toronto in there. Washington. Am I forgetting someone or not?
Atlanta. Did you throw them
in
there?
Yeah, and Atlanta, right. So where do you see the Wizards likely falling in that hierarchy? And are there any playoff matchups among those teams you'd be particularly excited for or wary of?
I think they're right now I think they're third or fourth. I think one of Chicago or Miami will beat them out. I'm a little down in Atlanta this year, and I'm really not sure what to make of Toronto and or Milwaukee. Are there any matchups that scare me? That's a good question. I think a team that has the capability of playing big or small and really making it tough defensively, I'm not sure how well they match, how they could stop Miami, for example, if Miami is really clicking. But, you know, with...
Yeah, I don't know who guards Bosch on this team.
Right. That I think, is going to be a big problem if they have to play the Heat. And you can't put Jared Dudley on him. You can't really put Humphries or Gooden. Maybe they need to dust Nene at the four back off to be able to make that work. That's a tough matchup. But other than that, I mean, they've proven they can beat the Bulls, and I think a lot of the same advantages still exist. They can go big if they want to in a playoff series. They just, you know, may not have to. I think they just didn't have the right matchups to. So I like them against almost any other team. I think they have a chance. Just Miami strikes me as a scary matchup for what you said.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this Bulls team is so different from that 2013-14 team. I think that it's that may not have that much predictive value. I think a Bulls-Wizards series in like the second round as the 2-3 series or something would be absolutely fascinating. I would love to see that. A ton of very interesting matchups in that series potentially. So, Rose and Wall.
They did play them well in the regular season last year, at least in January. I think there were like two or three games where they really just beat them up with their front court. So I'm still convinced that's a pretty good matchup for the Wizards. But you're right, it is a different Bulls team. You know, Jimmy Butler is a much better player, and the Wizards don't have a great matchup for him either. So we'll see.
All right, so best-case scenario, what's the record? What has to go right to make that happen?
I think if they can get in the low to mid 50s is the best case scenario. And that, if that were to happen, that means that Wall is an MVP candidate. Beal is an all-star. Gortat kind of is still a very effective player. Their style persists all year. And they get quality minutes out of two of Webster, Anderson, and Dudley. I mean, quality minutes to a player where they stay healthy and they can be counted on to finish games at the right moments. It's all that and the last thing is that Nene takes to the back of five well, and he doesn't miss too much time, and this actually kind of allows him to play a smaller role and keep his body fresh. If all that happens, I think they could win in the low to mid-50s. The worst-case scenario is that Beal doesn't really progress. Nene gets hurt for a while. Dudley and Anderson are just not the same players they were in the past. They just aren't as effective. Beal kind of stagnates, maybe gets some more leg issues, and it then becomes John Wall kind of carrying 14 scrubs, which sort of felt like what it was at times last year. That would be the worst case. I find it hard to believe that a team with a healthy John Wall misses the playoffs, but, you know, I could see them getting a 6-7 seed and losing in the first round as a worst case.
Yeah, I could see maybe some of those other teams at the bottom, maybe with Paul George maybe looking like he's back, you could see maybe like, you know, the Pacers finished with 45 wins and the Wizards struggle with health and kind of are in that high, or, you know, that low 40s range. Again, I think this team could win 55 games if this new offense thing plays out, right? You were talking about them maybe getting in to be a top 10 offense. Well, if they maintain the defense at 5 and they get to just even like average offense or slightly above there, you could get to a team that could be a 55 win team potentially.
Yeah. I mean, hey, I'm drinking the Kool-Aid now. So you're preaching to the choir there. If they're like 10th in both offense and defense, that's, I think, a reasonable goal. And that would, yeah, I mean, that gets you to 50 almost right there.
All right. So last question for you now. How would you rate this regime? I mean, it's been the same GM, Ernie Grunfeld, as I was reminded by reading the Gilbert Arenas, Javaris Crittenden standoff. He was still the GM back in whatever that was, 2010. You know, it's been the same ownership with Ted Leonsis for a while. How would you rate this regime with a letter grade?
Yeah, it's a tough one because for a couple of years I was very critical of the way they did their business. I thought, you know, the way they stuck with Andrew Blatch, Nick Young, Jerome McGee for so long, I thought they were really, that was a real detriment. And then I didn't really like the way they kind of, at first, they brought in all these veterans. And frankly, a lot of those bets have worked out a lot better than I anticipated. I think they've really beefed up, you know, some of their old school leanings. I think their analytics department is underrated. I think they've done a really good job identifying veterans that have some upside, that have the skills they need. I mean, Gortat they got when he was really struggling. You know, Ariza they got when he was really struggling. Even Ramon Sessions was someone that was just awful in Sacramento, and they traded for him, and they realized that even though he's getting to the rim a lot, even though he's missing, that's a skill we need, and he really helped them at times down the stretch. So I'm going to give them a B. I mean, it's just so hard. They've encompassed so long. They've been there that they've been basically through three rebuilds to the top level. But I think they're finally now starting to kind of find their groove. What's really going to cost them, I think, and what might cost them Durant down the road is that the way they messed up the 2011 draft, where they get Vesely, Chris Singleton, and Shelvin Mack with three picks. They don't get Kawhi Leonard. They don't get Klay Thompson, obviously. They don't get a better wing. I mean, and they're really deficient with young talent up front. Even a couple years ago, I mean, it would be nice to have Nerlens Noel on this team. That might cost them down the line. They've done a good job of kind of patching things up and building a pretty good team despite that, but that's a tough hole to overcome when you kind of mess that up so badly.
Yeah, the Wall pick, I think, was a pretty obvious one. You can't necessarily give them a ton of credit for that. I think that they did well to get Beal where they did in that draft. You know, I don't think that there was another obvious pick that they should have taken. Maybe you could say Andre Drummond would have been the other one that might have been better, but I don't know that you should say that Drummond is necessarily a better prospect than Beal at this point. And then the Porter pick was looking like a disaster through about a year and a half. Now it looks like that might turn out okay, especially when you consider how bad the rest of that top 10 really turned out to be in 2013. If they get an average starter out of it, which he looks like he's now on path to be, hopefully, and maybe even a little bit better than that. So yeah, things seem to have started to turn a little bit for this team. And even the Nene trade, I think you have to say that was probably a good trade.
Yeah.
Especially when you consider that McGee ended up signing for almost as much as Nene did, and that contract has just been dead money for a couple of years now. So those are some pretty good moves. The Ariza move, getting him was a good move, I think. Even the trade to get Emeka Okafor, the trade to get Gortat turned out to be a pretty good one as well. So that's another one that you can point to. I mean, I think getting a starting center on the team, he'll be signed for not too bad of a salary. People kind of blanched at that, but then the cap went up, and now that's going to be fine, his salary for the next few years. So, yeah, I think that this team, in a lot of ways, and even, you know, with Whitman now, it seems like he is kind of evolving a little bit. So maybe old dogs can learn new tricks is kind of the lesson here.
Yeah, I think they've really turned it around. The big test is just, I mean, right now they're nailing stuff that, you know, they have information on these veterans and they found the right fits and it works because they have the star talent to kind of put them around. You know, what's going to be interesting is they need to, I think, get value out of their graphics and, you know, they need Kelly Oubre to be a pretty good player and they need to be able to get someone good this year in this year's draft. They need to keep having Porter develop and, you know, that's ultimately what makes your team's infrastructure. And that's why I say 2011 was just such a disaster for them, and they're still, I think, they've recovered nicely, I think, from that, but they're still paying infrastructure-wise for that mistake. You know, how much better would they look if they had a young big man instead of Vesely that they could kind of in the pipeline and developing? I mean, that's a big gap they don't have. But I think a B is probably fairest.
What do you think of Oubre, by the way?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people around the league aren't really big fans of him, but then there are some that are really big fans of him. He's very divisive. I didn't watch them too much in college, but I think that there's potential for something there. You know, he's got really good ball. He's a much better ball handler than I realized. He's obviously not that passer, but defensively he has the tools. I think he has the willingness, and he's pretty crafty around the rim. He's got to, they got to work with him a little bit on his shot and obviously his court vision. But if you think
yeah,
a little bit
about...
Yeah,
he has no right hand whatsoever, too, which is a little disappointing.
Yeah.
I was actually... I talked to Jerome Williams at Summer League, who was involved with his AAU program, and I was like, Jerome, you don't teach guys to, like, use their offhand at all? And he kind of chuckled and said, yeah, you know, we tried. But, yeah, so he's got a little ways to go there, but obviously has the talent, and I think it's a lot of it is just the knock on him is sort of whether he really has, like, the dog in him from a mentality standpoint.
Yeah, that's a question. But he could also, the way their team is playing, long-term, he might be a four. And if they continue with the style change, that whether they get Durant or not, that's interesting. So I think that it made sense for them to swing for the fences there, you know. But I do think they need to develop in the right way. And that has been a problem in the past. And we'll see if it's a lot better now that they have a real solid infrastructure and core in place.
Yeah, is there anyone else that you were kind of hoping that they would get? Or were you happy with that pick at the time? And were you happy with the trade up from 19 to get him?
Yeah, there are a few guys I thought they should have. Bobby Portis was the guy they should have looked at. I thought that Justin Anderson is the guy they looked at. But, you know, the explanation that I've kind of heard for why they did what they did, and it makes sense, is that they look at it as those guys are going to be decent pros, but that's probably it. They didn't think that those guys really had a lot of upside, and where they're at, I think they thought they needed someone that had the potential to really morph into a special guy. And that's why they looked at Kelly Oubre, and that was a guy that they felt had that potential. And so they took the swing, and you know, that they'd rather do that than pick someone that could be a decent player, maybe, because nobody they were going to draft in their mind is really going to step in and play a lot for them. So why kind of use that as a criteria for who they take? That was their that's what I've heard was their logic. And so I've come around a little bit. Again, it certainly wasn't on my radar when I was kind of studying the draft, but I, you know, it makes sense when you hear it that way.
Yeah. Well, and he was expected to be gone before they initially were going to pick at 19 anyway.
Right.
So, and it's interesting, right? I kind of think about what this team is going to look like if they did get Durant. They basically are going to have no big men on the roster other than Gortat at that point. They're going to have to kind of strip down to get him. I mean, they'll basically have the room exception and then kind of minimums and whoever they draft next year and Oubre. So, yeah, maybe you could argue they could have used a guy who at least would be a contributing rotation player like a Portis without as much upside. But certainly, you know, the draft is drafting for need is fraught with peril, as we know as well. Last question. What do you think happens with the Brad Beal extension? Is there any chance it gets done, or are they just going to hold off because they can get that extra cap room without signing him next summer?
You know, I'm not sure. Because of, you know, preparing for a wedding, I haven't really been able to get too much clarity on that.
Such a poor excuse.
I know. But I think all the reasons that it would make sense not to do the extension now kind of still apply. You know, his cap hold is lower, and he doesn't seem inclined to give them a discount. I think he wants a max, and, you know, so I still doubt it happened. But maybe if he can agree to something like 17 or 18 million, you know, then maybe the fact that it's a little more than the cap hold is fine, and they'd rather take him at a little bit of a discount down the road. But I would be surprised if it gets done. And, you know, it just the incentives just don't line up for either side to do it.
I largely agree with you there. We've talked about this on past programs, but his max will probably be starting at about $21 million. His cap hold is in the mid-14. So it's basically by not signing him, you open up about $7 million in additional space for next summer. And if they do sign him to the max right now, it'll be pretty darn close to whether they can fit in Durant starting at $25 million or anyone else that they wanted to max out for that matter. And if they did sign Durant, having that extra $7 million would be fantastic, because then maybe you can sign another big man. They're just not, as we talked about, they're not going to have anybody. So that's another concern. All right, I'll let you get out of here. Where can we find you on Twitter?
You can find me, my name, Mike Prada, spelled like the Italian company, but not pronounced that way. And then SBN, the acronym for where I work. That's where you can find me. You probably won't hear from me too much over the next couple weeks. I'll be a little busy, but that's where you can find me. In the meantime, I do have to
follow that account for photos of palm trees, swimming pools, beaches, that sort of thing, if that's what you need for your NBA prep.
I promise to filter them in a very special way to make it worthwhile. but we do have our season preview coming out while I'm gone. I'm really excited about this one. I don't want to reveal too much, but this one I think is going to be the best one we've done, and I think we've done some good ones. We have a couple big feature stories and some cool visual elements that I'm really excited about that should come out in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, and I've been enjoying the features that you, because Mike's also an editor at SB Nation, so the features that SB Nation's been doing with Tom Ziller and Paul Flannery talking about various teams, those have been pretty interesting as well. I've read a couple of those, so I'd recommend those as well. As for us, of course, you can follow me on Twitter, Nate Duncan NBA. Keep up with the podcast and my writing at my Facebook page. That's also Nate Duncan NBA. If you would like to support the podcast and help us stay on the air and make sure that I don't end up next to a freeway off-ramp holding a piece of cardboard in 5 years, you can use the cap space code on DraftKings or with SeatGeek. That would be a great way to support the podcast. Or an iTunes rating, if you're enjoying these, also really helps us as well. So that'll do it for this Wizards season preview. Thanks so much to Mike for coming on, for him and myself. We will talk to y'all next time.